John Ralston's Saul took aim at three institutions that produced the rational elites responsible for neoliberalism: the Chicago University and its School of Economics, Harvard Business School, and the École Nationale d'Administration in France. These schools have done more to spread the gospel of deregulation and libertarian economics than anywhere else. Business and economics institutions worldwide fall under the shadow of these centers. They carried the new orthodoxy. There are always heterodox thinkers and practitioners in economics and business, but in the 40 years of neoliberalism's hold on the commanding heights of the world economy, no alternative had arisen, not until modern monetary theory. William Mitchell, professor of economics at the University of Newcastle, together with an American bond trader, Warren Mosler, spent the latter half of the 1990s and the early 2000s developing the complex of economic ideas that would come to be known as MMT. This new macroeconomic theory would be the convergence of an astute money market practitioner who knew how the banking system worked in practice and a heterodox academic economist par excellence. It is how closely theory follows the reality of how money is created by currency-issuing sovereign governments that makes MMT unique among schools of macroeconomics. In February 2019, Mitchell published his textbook, Setting Out Macroeconomic Theory from an MMT Perspective. In conversation, Mitchell told me, the light went on for me on a cold winter day in Melbourne. I was in my fourth year at Melbourne University, and one of the subjects in my honours year was agricultural economics. And of course, at that time, we had the wool price stabilisation scheme. The farming lobby had pressured the government to guarantee to stabilise their income so they didn't go up and down with the vagaries of the wool clip. We learned that the government bought all that surplus to the market and kept the price stable. And when there was shortage, always sold it out of those big red brick wool stores all around the cities. At the time we were talking in 1978, I wasn't particularly interested in wool, but I remember sitting in the lecture and thinking, while the lecturer, who was Alan Lloyd, was talking, that this is a full employment scheme for wool and an inflation stabilization scheme. This was the government using its fiscal capacity, which it had as the currency issuer, to make sure that the price was stable and creating a buffer stock of wool to ensure that. So I became quite interested in buffer stock mechanisms, and that's what I wrote up as the final paper in that year, the job guarantee concept. Mitchell explains further, MMT is not a regime or a set of policies. Rather, it is a lens which provides a superior understanding of our monetary system. By linking institutional reality with behavioral theories, MMT allows us to understand the capacities of the currency-issuing government and the consequences of different policy choices. To operationalize an MMT understanding into policy, one has to overlay a set of values, ideology. But MMT is politically agnostic. Most policy choices that are couched in terms of budgets and financial constraints are, in fact, just political or ideological choices. MMT cuts through the fictions that mainstream economists use to obscure reality. These fictions deliberately restrict fiscal space and distort the political choices that citizens make. Paul Samuelson likened fictions about the dangers of fiscal deficits and debt to, quote, old-fashioned religion, which was to scare people by sometimes what might be regarded as myths into behaving in a way that long-run civilized life requires. Martin Wolf wrote of MMT that, quote, it is right because there is no simple budget constraint. It is wrong because it will prove impossible to manage an economy sensibly once politicians believe there is no budget constraint. This is the core of modern monetary theory, and I quote Mitchell, consider two scenarios. At full employment, inflationary pressures will arise if government competes at market prices with non-government spending for productive resources. To increase its use of productive resources but avoid inflationary pressures, the government has to free up resources. Taxation is one option because it reduces non-government purchasing power and creates the real resource space to accommodate non-inflationary government spending. Importantly, the taxes do not provide any extra spending capacity for government. In the second scenario, idle productive resources can be brought back into productive use with higher deficits. There are no constraints, financial or resource, on such government spending. Fiscal space is thus much broader than mainstream economists suggest and is defined in terms of available real resources rather than numbers in fiscal statements. MMT focuses on how policy advances desired functional outcomes rather than what the state of the deficit might be. MMT runs contrary to the neoliberal orthodoxy in basic respects. Firstly, it says that the national economy is not like a household budget. While a household or a company or any other entity, such as a state, must balance income and expenditure, the sovereign government that issues its own currency is not so constrained. There is no imperative to balance the national budget or be in surplus. Secondly, flowing from the fallacious analogy of the household budget, MMT says that every dollar of public deficit is a surplus on the private side. The implications for private economic capacity in circumstances of constrained government investment due to the prioritization of budget surpluses fall out of the MMT argument. Thirdly, the government's fiscal capacity is not the product of taxation. Taxation is a tool to manage private behavior in the economy, but is not the source of money. The government issues the currency as the first step in the process of the circulation of money. This is done by pressing print on the relevant computer. Fourthly, MMT says that the limit to the government's capacity to create and spend money is the availability of real resources in the economy in which the money can be invested. If government expenditure is directed at assets that are already subscribed, then there will be inflation. Inflation is the constraint on government spending, not its capacity to pay. Fifthly, MMT says that high levels of budget deficit and government debt are not constraints on economic activity or employment. Government debt levels before the pandemic in Australia were 46% of GDP compared to 109% in the United States, 85% in the United Kingdom and 238% in Japan. Japan has been in a deflationary period with near zero interest rates, high employment, and high economic activity, accompanied by high government debt for almost three decades. All of these aspects of the MMT argument run completely contrary to the neoliberal nostrums about household budgets, maxing out the credit card, no free lunch, and invocations of the runaway inflation of Weimar Germany and Mugabe's Zimbabwe. These are the standard objections, a set of reflexive arguments that are deeply ingrained in the current public understanding of these crucial questions of economics and democracy. A neoliberal catechism has been rote learned by an entire generation. All of this is highly allergic to the economics to which both the Liberal National Coalition and Labour are wedded. Yet, whatever the theoretical objections of mainstream politicians, this is not the practice of central banks and treasuries around the world. Japan has been the case study of MMT for 30 years, and the rest of the world has been engaged since the GFC, and certainly since the pandemic, in debt and deficit financing that can only be understood through an MMT lens. The threats of inflation and high interest rates predicted by the orthodoxy have not materialized, and deficits have grown around the world without the collateral disasters predicted by the sound finance mainstream. What is remarkable to me is that a collection of economic insights distilled under the banner of MMT, under the intellectual leadership of an Australian, has not caused the Labour Party to realise that there is an economic policy alternative to the neoliberal orthodoxy. MMT comes from the centre of full employment and equity at a regional university outside of the sandstone dogma and beyond the spell of Harvard and Chicago. William Mitchell is better known in the United Kingdom and Europe and has more engagement with politicians in the ruling party of the Japanese National Diet than he does with Australian politicians. This is a simple lack of imagination. Labour cannot see and does not have the courage to grapple with the illumination that MMT provides in understanding the world economic situation and how Australia might move forward in a new way. Martin Wolf's assessment that the only reason MMT is wrong is that awareness of the government's real fiscal capacity by politicians would make economic management impossible is a devastatingly accurate account of the current state of affairs and profoundly depressing. Wolf is saying that the last people who should know the truth are the pack of dummies we elect as our representatives to the parliament. Following Samuelson, only the eunuchs at the rarefied top of the treasuries and reserve banks, such as Ben Bernanke, Paul Volcker, and not least Alan Greenspan, and his Australian equivalents up to Philip Lowe, could be entrusted with the truth. They studiously kept their political counterparts in the land of naive theology. Richard Cook's devastating critique in the November 2020 issue of The Monthly points out the absurdity of Labour's attempts to position itself as a deficit scold of the Morrison government in response to the pandemic. just as the potential for social democracy to realize its fiscal capacity had come into view, its political party was trying to position itself as the upholder of neoliberal budgetary rectitude. This is despite Keating's comments, reported in The Australian in October 2019, before the pandemic, which picked up on his 2017 views that liberal economics had run its course. The report says, Mr. Keating, who delivered four budget surpluses as Treasurer, said the current quest for a surplus should not be regarded as sacrosanct. Monetary policy has run its race, he said. There is no more that central banks can do. Even if the Reserve Bank of Australia moved into the Australian version of quantitative easing, the impact would be so economically marginal as to be not worth doing. We are moving into a new world of big government after 30 or 40 years of smaller government, because with world growth shrinking and monetary policy being incapable of providing the stimulus, the building of infrastructure by governments and by private industry, perhaps acting in concert, is the way forward. The case for fiscal expansion is simply staring you in the face. The accounts of a nation are not like a household account. They don't have to run in surplus because a nation can tax and can grow. So fiscal policy today is not stimulatory enough and needs to be made much more stimulatory, rapidly. This is what I didn't know. It would affect my mission for 20 years. If I had known then what I know now, I would have invested my energies in fighting for a universal job guarantee as the answer to the problem of passive welfare. What I didn't know would not have changed my convictions about the nature of the problem facing our people, but rather about its solution. I was diverted, along with everyone else, by the ideas that justified permanent structural unemployment for the lowest classes in Australia. I swallowed the fiction that full employment wasn't about every person who wants work having work, but that it was some unfixed number determined by the country's economic managers to be around 95% of the workforce. I accepted the fiscal constraints on the government's capacity to afford such a program. Moreover, I internalized the general disdain with which public job programs were viewed. They were make work, involving painting rocks, and so on. I had, of course, accepted the argument of the economists about the trade-off between employment and inflation, and that managing inflation was the first imperative. All of these ideas I took as gospel. That governments should be challenged to ensure all citizens wanting work have the opportunity through public job programs never occurred to me. I consigned such ideas to the socialist trash can as the unrequited desire of leftists from a bygone and unfashionable era. Excusing government from its responsibility for jobs meant that all our efforts in these two decades were directed towards enabling the unemployed to find and take up whatever jobs were available and to create jobs wherever possible. We looked to the private sector to generate these jobs, but in a remote region with limited capabilities, we were conscious that we would fall short and mass job creation would not materialize. In the meantime, passive welfare was corroding the social fabric of our communities, and we had to attend to its immediate problems. We couldn't wait for the solution of jobs while life on welfare remained so debilitating. That is why we pursued and never resiled from the need for welfare reform. There are two aspects to the welfare reform we advocated. First, we placed a high priority on measures that ameliorated the social effects of long-term dependency on individuals and families. We sought to foster the basic functioning of households so that everyone could meet basic needs. This is critical. And even with the benefit of hindsight, we wouldn't change what we have done to support our people to live as well as they can in an unsatisfactory economy without jobs. The second concerns policies that oblige and support the transition from welfare to work. This is distinct from the first purpose. It is about taking advantage of whatever job opportunities there might be for unemployed people. This is distinct from the first purpose. It is about taking advantage of whatever job opportunities there may be for unemployed people. This is a question of incentives to remain on welfare or to choose work in a regional economy without a job-creating labour market. Welfare to work ends up churning unemployed people through bureaucratic compliance processes that reward the industry administering them but do nothing for the unemployed. I've been conscious of the self-serving employment industry that has arisen in the name of welfare reform, amounting to an annual $12 billion expenditure, and have been clear-eyed about the limitation of private sector job creation in places such as the communities of Cape York. Without the foundation of government jobs programs, there is no way we will ever solve the crisis that unemployment has caused in our society. And yet, it is astounding to me to confront what the absence of full employment has meant for our people, in particular, and for the lowest classes generally in Australia. In 2018, the Productivity Commission released Rising Inequality, a stock take of the evidence. While the Commission might have a neoliberal view of inequality, its report is unequivocal about a core group of the underclass who most suffer from equality. The report says, many Australians experience economic disadvantage at some stage in their lives, but for most, it is temporary. About 9% of Australians, 2.2 million people, experienced relative income poverty, income below 50% of the median, in 2015-16, with children and older people having the highest rates of relative income poverty. This aggregate figure has fluctuated since 1988-89, but despite 27 years of uninterrupted growth, has not declined. Persistent and recurrent poverty affects a small but significant proportion of the population. About 3% of Australians, roughly 700,000 people, have been in income poverty continuously for at least the last 4 years. People living in single-parent families, unemployed people, people with disabilities, and Indigenous Australians are particularly likely to experience income poverty, deprivation, and social exclusion. For people in these circumstances, there's an elevated risk of economic disadvantage, becoming entrenched, limiting their potential to seize economic opportunities or develop the skills with which to overcome these conditions. It is this group that is permanently excluded from the economy and intergenerationally dependent on welfare. While the unemployment buffer in the economy has fluctuated, the people described here by the Productivity Commission have always comprised the unemployed, or those not seeking work. Those not seeking work is a euphemism for people permanently excluded from work. This underclass represents families and communities and regions suffering a full range of social, educational, and health failure, mental illness, physical disability, and entrenched cycles of dysfunction and disadvantage, leaving people with low skills and little to no work experience and representing little to no value to employers. The serious challenges to work participation of the underclass mean they are written off, and though they receive services for their disability or debility, there is no concerted policy to break these cycles and to diminish levels of debility. Policy assumes that the debilitated have always been debilitated, but the point of my story of Arakun is that current levels of debility were created by policy. Australian economic policy of the past 50 years created this social disaster and continues to sustain its replication. The political violence of the Queensland government was bad enough, but the economic policy of successive Commonwealth governments that systemically relegated Australia's most vulnerable people to permanent exclusion from the economy is a more reprehensible story. It is one which applied across Indigenous Australia and the underclass of which it was a part. The politicians and technocrats who allowed this social disaster to play out have never been held to account for what they did and are still doing. They destroyed lives. They did this so that the rest of us prospered from the economy they presided over. And what is worse, they are using the most disadvantaged to prop up the macroeconomic system to manage wages and inflation. 3 to 5% of the country enable the 95% to enjoy the advantages and prosperity that are the right of all Australians, but not available to all. Whenever an Australian politician approves of employment numbers that are less than full employment, they're essentially saying that it is acceptable and correct that this 3 to 5% be excluded from the life-sustaining opportunities other Australians enjoy. Think about it. The structure of economic prosperity and well-being sits on top of a buffer of permanent unemployment representing the bodies of the underclass and their children. These are the people for whom educational failure, poor health, out-of-home care for children, family dysfunction, and juvenile and adult incarceration are at acute levels. This underclass suffers these problems on an intergenerational basis, and the country has no solution to offer them. This much the Productivity Commission admitted. What is not admitted is that our advantage sits directly atop this misery. If they didn't help make up the numbers of the unemployment buffer, and if they didn't gift their families and their bodies to it, we wouldn't have the system of economic management that has underwritten our good fortune for decades now. Bill Mitchell's design of the job guarantee, proposing an employment buffer rather than an unemployment buffer through a minimum wage, makes this story even more sickening. It was not necessary to use an unemployment buffer to manage wage inflation. Inflation could have been managed through an employment buffer using the minimum wage. Consider two absurdities. First, that of the employment compliance industry, costing $12 billion annually. How can welfare-to-work reform succeed without jobs? Sure, private sector job opportunities arise and workers take advantage of them, but they also disappear. A public job guarantee scheme would complement private sector job creation. If the $12 billion that funds the employment compliance industry were instead invested in a public job guarantee, we would not need this parasitic industry. The second absurdity is condemning welfare dependents for not having jobs that are not available. Yes, a percentage of jobs become available and are not taken up as a result of poor incentives and the effect of habituation on passive welfare dependency, but the larger story is the non-availability of work, which can only be solved through a public job program. If we want all Australians to work for their income, then we need to provide them with the necessary jobs. Public policy choices were made by the Treasury and the Reserve Bank for the underclass. The Treasury decided public job programs were unaffordable, and the Reserve Bank interpreted the data of full employment in a way that could not be more careless of the implications and impact on Australia's poorest citizens. The choices they made spoke volumes for their concern for this underclass. They never saw any value in these people. They never saw that the children of the debilitated should have the chance to be free of debility themselves if proper public policy were made in their favour. Why should intergenerational disadvantage be taken to be inevitable, unbreakable, and acceptable? Look at the Reconciliation Action Plan of the Reserve Bank. This RAP sets out the commitments of public, private, and civil society organisations to advance reconciliation with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. The Reserve Bank makes three commitments: to provide opportunities to increase the number of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander staff in the bank's workforce and develop the bank's cultural competence, and to increase awareness and respect, and to build relationships. The bank employs one Indigenous person. These commitments, not the least to cultural competence, are of course ridiculous in the light of what we have traversed here. This RAP should have instead restated the bank's obligation to provide full employment for all Australians, including Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, who have not enjoyed full employment since we became citizens in 1967. This is the commitment that will make reconciliation real.